what us and us, like people like us, could do, you know, to, so the point is, what sort of intervention could we have? At the same time, local government, like in Zhongli County this year, alone, there were 754 kind of registered sort of small companies.
You
know, government encouraged local entrepreneurship, but at the same time, there is the problem of capitals, problem of skill development.
Well, no, I mean that goes, you know, back to the work of Bridge, and then back to the work of a lot of these different initiatives and organizations of social entrepreneurship and so on, is to develop those capacities, develop those skills, and help to support businesses and so on. And as I'm saying, you know, back in the, you know, in the first book I wrote, that's what I was really emphasizing, is this is what, you know, if you look at the situation of the Tibetan population, still with high levels of literacy, although presumably less among the young population. What is the type of economic development you would want in those types of contexts, right? And how is that getting distorted by this context, right? And I think there's, in that sense, this, because it's less polarized in, say, Sichuan or Qinghai or Gansu, maybe there's more possibility for a lot of indigenous, you know, initiatives to not get completely distorted by, say, the types of conditions that exist in TAR, for instance, right? Although it depends also on the political situation and, you know, all those things. But yeah, I mean, definitely, the Tibetans are one of the youngest, they still have the highest population growth in China, and they are one of the youngest populations in China, alongside the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Although that's falling, but now you're basically entering to what demographers call the demographic dividend, or the, you know, the youth, the previous baby boom now that's entering into 20s and 30s and so on. And so employment generation is this huge issue, right? As it is elsewhere in China, and I think the government, that's another issue that the government is in China is very aware of. It's this, the need to generate employment is huge, right? And again, as part of the developmentalist mindset, is okay, how do we create the employment? But you know, that's presumably there would be a substantial amount of trickle down from this type of situation, right? You know, there is the spin-offs of aggregate demand circulating through the economy, which creates opportunities for Tibetans to then set up businesses and so on. But then you have the social exclusion, you have the discrimination, you have the competition from outside migrants, you have government policy and the politicization of any local incentives and so on. And there's all these issues that local entrepreneurship faces, right? As you know, this is the challenge, right? What do you think? Yeah.
How to make sense of this big data with the everyday people's life?
I know exactly. It's always challenging when you present the big data. The big structural data allows you to sort of have a picture, you know, in the grand scale, you know, what are basically sort of the structural forces that are operating, that are conditioning your life, right? To then go back to the micro and say, okay, well, what do we do with this, right? It's useful to have this understanding as the interpretive lens that allows you to understand, you know, the changes that you feel and you see, but then you maybe don't quite understand, and that does affect people's behavior, right? It does, you know, the problem with what they call micro foundations in economics is you focus only on the micro, you know, and then you assume that just the macro is the aggregation of all the micro individual. The problem is that when you aggregate up to the macro, you get all sorts of contradictory dynamics that then do feed back down into the micro again, right? And so we need to develop a way of understanding the micro that both appreciates the agency of the individual while at the same time understanding how they're influenced and constrained by the broader structural circumstances, right, in the institutional context and so on. So that's the challenge in social sciences, right? You know, but you know, I myself am not an entrepreneur, and I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, the simple answer is, yeah, I mean, especially these guys who don't have the university education, but definitely the development of technical skills, of vocational education, which is hugely underfunded in the threat areas, which I showed in my first book, which would develop skills and the types of things, the types of activities where they could build up businesses, business development to get access to some of these subsidies and road construction or housing construction, or and to be able to compete with, so to be able to access a lot of these opportunities that are created through this nonetheless subsidized economy, right? And the question is to what degree is government policy allowing that to happen or facilitating it? Or is it an uphill struggle that has to be entirely conducted despite the government, right? Which is, I think, a conversation you're constantly having in Machik and Tibet Dalton, right?
So. Well, I mean, your question is that, assuming that in the macro, you know, statistics you're showing, is these government expenditure or GDP in the Tibetan area, and these are including mostly government, you know, the government cost for the running the government, particularly now the security is like a huge cost,
right?
And so mostly just, you know, absorbed by these kind of costs, and compared to that, to just average people who's open little shops and run little things, and these are so small proportion to that picture. So I think if you want to see the how much a part of Tibetan daily lives to that, you know, that picture is probably quite small, that thinking. And it's almost like, I always say that, you know, the Tibetan economy is almost like it's running in two different orbits. It's like both, you know, the Tibetans, you know, the people, average people's lives in one orbit, and then the government, Tibet, you know, running another orbit, and they intersect, but they're not quite the same thing, and they're just running in different orbit.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the understanding the because in this process, there's a radical transformation of, say, people's consumption, right? There's a radical transformation of the circulation of value in the economy, the circulation of goods in the economy, the nature of employment. Employment is changing, right? It's changing without necessarily sort of the agrarian economy changing that much. So the agrarian economy remains more or less, you know, what it was 20 years ago, although people move out of it and but consumption changes, right? And so how, I mean, I used to actually, this is why I was getting, I did some research in sort of economic development in, well, indigenous communities like Cree and Northern Quebec at one point. And I was really struck when they were, you know, if you think what would be the, in those types of contexts where you have this subsistence, you know, relatively, it's okay subsistence economy, you know, people can survive in it and so on. And then you have these big projects like hydroelectric dams, and then people are increasingly having motorbikes and mobile phones and all these modern forms of consumption, which are all consumption, they're not production. Production isn't happening in your economy, right? So, you know, there's two classic approaches you can take to that. One is specialization, the comparative advantage idea, specialization. So you just do specialize in one thing, and you do that at a massive scale. You scale up, but the problem is it doesn't employ a huge amount of people, and you become very, very productive in that. Like the Salar communities in Chensa are very successful at manufacturing, right? It's not the case that there isn't manufacturing of Tibetan wool, it's just that the sector became dominated by the Hui and Salar Muslims, right? And the Tibetans couldn't compete with them. So, and they were, how did they compete? I could have shown you more photos. They mechanized, they automized. I mean, I was visiting Salar factories in Chensa, the Salar one, Xunhua. In Xunhua in 2003, 2004, 2005, and already then they were importing technology from Japan and Germany, and you had these young Salar women who were just standing by the machines that were all doing automized production of like Muslim skull caps, which they're exporting to Saudi Arabia. And this is one economic strategy, right? But there was a moment when in Amdo they could have taken that direction in the 80s, right? But they were a lot of county town ventures. They weren't very well efficiently run and so on, and they all more or less fell apart in the face of both the government pulling the plug of subsidies and competition from more efficient producers, right? So this is the classic sort of, you know, the dog-eat-dog world of competition and capitalism, right? The other approach is you say, okay, well, how do I substitute the imports that I'm importing from abroad with my own consumption and generate economic activities that way, right? So you look at all what you're consuming and what can I replace with my own production, right? And I think a lot of the social movements around, how to say, social cultural identity movements actually do play a role in the material economy in that sense of saying, hey, you know, let's assert our own forms of consumption. It's not just about our identity, but it's also perhaps has an economic function of saying, yes, let's eat zappa and not instant noodles or something like that, right? In the face of the pressure to assimilate, right? So yeah, I mean, if you're in a situation where you can have any influence over that, there's a lot of different strategies to take, And my old point is always, when the government's throwing in so many subsidies like that, you have the space to experiment. You know, if they would direct even a small portion of these subsidies towards Tibetans to try out different things and so on, try new economic ventures and support businesses and so on, they could, you know, it could potentially create dramatic change or not, perhaps. Maybe then it would create dysfunctional state-owned businesses.
There's one more thing.
Yeah.
That Chen Jiabo announced infamous, you know, party secretary in Xinjiang. Before he was there in TAR, he was the party secretary, and he was allegedly told in a meeting.
Yeah.
That before he came to Tibet.
Yeah.
He was Hebei or Hunan or some governor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think somebody complained that, you know, Tibet, we have to do something about Tibetan economy in Tibet. And he famously said that, you know, central government sent me here and not develop, you know, mm-hmm. looking after the economy.
Yeah.
He said, I know how to do economy.
Yeah.
I have done this there.
Yeah.
But here, my job is, you know, maintaining the stability. This is my job, not running
exactly.
the economy. So
maybe
there's a chance that, you know, for them that's not priority.
Exactly. No, it's definitely. So it's up to the people to make it the priority too, right?
Yeah.
But see, the attitude, I mean, even, you know, the poverty of plenty, right? Wong and Bei. You know, they wrote it in the 80s, and, you know, it was considered to be quite of a, that was
liberal,
pushing the line, and liberal, and so on. But actually, fundamentally, at the essence of it, it was actually quite, you know, racially derogatory, and you could say racist, because you know, their essential argument was like, why are Tibetans essentially, or a few other ethnic minorities, behaving like Fujian people, and why aren't they being entrepreneurial, right? And they have all this asset wealth, and they don't do anything with it. They're just sitting around and they potentially could be the richest people in China, but they're not entrepreneurial. They're not acting like capitalists, right? That was basically their analysis. And they said it was because it was their backwardness, right? So it was like you're back to a very old colonial type of discourse about Tibetans being backward, right? Of course, they were talking about a context where, you know, it just, like, decollectivized, and I've written about that in my book chapter 7 about the subsistence capacity in terms of how that also structures your incentives and so on. I really like that part of the book, although I think it's more academic, it's theoretical. But that's what also struck me in the Tibetan areas, and I think this is part of the reason why they couldn't compete with the Salar Muslims, is because they actually were coming out of subsistence economy that was relatively affluent. You know, they had a good amount of subsistence assets, of especially in the pastoral areas, right? That set a fairly relatively to, you know, the Salar Hui Muslims or the Chinese coming from Sichuan and so on, set a relatively higher standard of, if they would go out of farming and herding, what wages they would expect, what labor conditions they would expect, and so on. And this is what you had a lot of people, Tibetans, trying to explain why all the Tibetan ventures just collapsed, is because they couldn't impose labor discipline, they couldn't get, you know, the Tibetans to show up to work on time, and, you know, and all these different things like that. You know, whereas you go to these factories with a seller and Khoi Muslim, and these are very poor farming areas. Just to give a simple example, I mean, in Xinhua, the amount of land per person that, and this was in mid-2000s, they had half a mu per person, right? A mu is 6 mus per acre, right? So they had a 1/12 of an acre per person. So if you stayed in farming, you were poor, basically, right?
For the Muslim.
Yeah, for the Salar Muslims, yeah. If you go up the valley to the Tibetan areas in Xinhua, they probably have about 2 or 3 mu per person, right, on which to farm. So on 2 or 3 mu, you can actually, it's still very small, but you can actually, you can grow enough to survive, right? Whereas in down in the valley with half a mu, you have to work, right? So it's sort of like the proletarianization of the labor, right? Whereas the Tibetans have more freedom to avoid, because no one likes to work in factories, right? You know, it's you know, working 8-10 hours a day, 6-7 days a week, in front of machines, and so on. But in the end, they actually become much more successful in this local form of manufacturing, right? And then they end up developing an industrial base in their counties on the basis of both, you know, some rich people who invest in it, and then having a workforce that they can use, right? Of young Salar and Khoi women, basically. Employing thousands of people, actually. Like, one factory is employing 1,000 people, another one is employing 1,500 people, and there's a really successful business group that got into real estate Shinning, and probably right now are super, super wealthy, right? The wealthiest man in Qinghai was the one who started one of these businesses. So, so, I mean, in that sense, the Tibetans ironically find themselves in a bit of a funny situation, but it's not because of backwardness, it's just that obviously you're not going to accept, if you have a certain degree of freedom on the basis of a certain type of subsistence wealth on which to provide for yourself, you're not going to run to a factory to, you know, and then how do you then just have to create a disciplined workforce to work in the factory, right? You know, because I mean, the unfortunate thing is that when things are not subsidized, or when they're not based on highly motivated, enthusiastic forms of voluntary labor that can keep, say, a social entrepreneur or social business going, right? And it has to then enter into a competitive capitalist economy, say running a business or running a restaurant or running a factory or whatever. And then you enter into the sort of political economy of capitalist relations and so on. It's hard to then maintain this is the challenge of social enterprises to scale up, I would say, right? Is that a social enterprise at a small scale, one or two, can thrive on the basis of a lot of really enthusiasm and effectively what becomes a form of voluntary labor, right? Which Tibetans can provide precisely because they have a fairly strong subsistence capacity, right? So it allows them to give voluntary labor if they want to do so, because they're not going to starve if they offer voluntary labor, right? So they can get involved in these types of ventures, and they have sort of relative degree of freedom to do so. But it's hard to then make that an economic model that you can scale up to 100, 200, 300 businesses and maintain the same degree of motivation and discipline, right? You know, and that's the challenge of social enterprise, right? Yeah?
Yeah, just looking at, like, predictive analytics, where would you see Tibet's economic trend going to the future, like, say, in the next 5-10 years?
In the macro sense, you'd have to ask Beijing. In the micro, the labor force is urbanizing rapidly, very rapidly. It's quite different from Xinjiang in that sense. So already the Tibetan labor force inside the TAR and outside the TAR is probably, I think, more than half urban, and the youth are urbanizing. So it'll become an urban economy, which means it will be less and less rooted in this agrarian subsistence conditions that their parents had. And it means that more and more it put the onus on competing in urban forms of employment and having types of education that support that, right? So, I mean, that's the future, right? That's the future of Tibet. I mean, I think at this point, I think we can all accept that it's more or less inevitable. And then, so what will those urban economies look like? I mean, I definitely 10 years ago, I would not have predicted that Remcon would look like what it looks like today. I mean, I simply would not have guessed that. You know? And I actually, it was funny, because in 2005, when I was in Remcon, I thought, wow, this is really, because, you know, you go to Lhasa and you're like, ah, it's so depressing, right? Because the Chinese are just, you know, rebuilding everything, and it's becoming more and more like a Chinese city besides a few beautiful historical buildings. And you go to Remcon and, you know, you say, wow, this is actually like an indigenous form of urbanization. You know, it's like, it's smaller scale, it's more accessible, it's the Tibetans who appear to be controlling it and so on. And it's like, you know, this is a really interesting example to study, a really interesting case to study of a more sort of, what you might call, yeah, indigenous or vernacular form of urbanization, right? That could be something that Tibetans could come to sort of have a certain degree of self-government and controlling, right? And then in 10 years later, it looks like a Chinese city, right? So I'm like, I don't know. It's like, I've given up on trying to predict things at this point. But anyways.
Maybe.
Okay.
That's the note and it's exactly 6:30. I will say one thing, which is that we asked you to do something that's undoable, which is to juxtapose all of this macroeconomics on top of, you know, the kinds of things that we usually talk about, and anecdotally, in terms of the kinds of research that people generally do, we see more, right? This is so much harder to discern the material conditions of the whole. And so that's why we asked Andrew to do that, to connect some of the dots. And he just generated some of these numbers today, so thank you for hurrying and doing that, because is there 2016?
It's from the 2017 yearbook, and the 2018 one hasn't come out yet, so so you're always 1 or 2 years behind when you're...
So many of you know the research brief that we did, what was it, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
So that was based on 2012 numbers. So what we're seeing, I mean, we call that a surge.
We call that
a surge in state subsidy in terms of fiscal policy. Now this is much higher than what
crazy.
We talked about in 2012. So just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. And so Andrew's going to wait for the new numbers. anybody coming out of China maybe can bring a yearbook.
Let me know if you go to China.
Correct me if I'm wrong, all the graphs that you showed, all the numbers were generated from statistical
data,
right?
There's no other way to get...
state-published, openly sourced, you know, information that we can use. So that is something else to say that why don't we have more analysis of this? Why do we have to wait for Andrew to... It's great for Andrew to do. But Andrew's earlier work really was the very first to start showing the exclusionary forces at work, you know, at the micro level. But I think often we don't have a sense of what's going on regionally, and in particular, you've talked about it, but it would be really great on another occasion, not today, to understand better the methodology of really thinking through trade flows within Tibet, within the Tibetan region, right? And then how outside of Tibet, across the rest of the Chinese state, because I think those of us really want to understand the structuring of the state need to kind of get a handle on all that.
Give me some PhD researchers
But I think you mentioned Wang Xiaoqiang by Nanfang. I think that really shows the power of macroeconomics. These were two economists who were state-sponsored economists in China, right? And coming out of Beijing, and because of what they said, which was, you know, very chauvinistic, et cetera. And yet, because of what they said, one was arrested, the other had to run out of the country, ended up at Cambridge. But in any case, the power of saying something at the macro level, how important it is, even if it's not radical, even if it's just describing very self-evident kind of things. And I really hope we can keep growing this conversation. Thank you so much, Andrew,
thank
for
you.
Putting this together. And we will
Yes, somebody else is.
We have.
hashtags and